Today's episode is sponsored by the fine folk at CV Check.
Yes, Craig, with the local economy and job market in recovery, we may feel tempted to rush to top talent through the screening process.
It's important not to hire with haste, Lauren, and you always go too quick. Get a clear candidate picture with CV's Check, fast online background screening, building confidence and trusted relationships.
So everybody, visit cvcheck.com today and tell them Tarpod sent you.
Welcome to Tarpod, the podcast for everything talent acquisition and recruitment. We're informative, controversial, and a little bit crazy. Now please join your hosts and industry leaders, Lauren Sharp and Craig Watson.
Hi everyone, welcome to Tarpod. I'm Craig.
And I'm Lauren, and today's wonderful guest is Nicola Harrison, the Director of Talent and Inclusion at RMIT University.
Welcome, Nicola. How are you?
Oh, I'm loving the applause and fanfare.
Great. I know, we're supposed to be in lockdown, huge. But we snuck a crowd in.
Yeah,
and they are social distanced. Hi, everyone.
They are socially distanced and wearing masks.
Yes, they are, they are. And how are you going in, you know, Melbourne's 4.0 lockdown?
I think it's 4.8, isn't it?
Yeah, but your kids have been doing fractions for their homeschooling, so you'd know all about bloody decimals and fractions.
Yeah.
I think it's lockdown day 169.
Is it?
Mm.
Jeez.
Yeah. What was that?
If you total up all of our lockdown days, I think we're in day lockdown of 169 lockdown days.
That's longer than your record relationship, I reckon, Lauren.
Oh, shit, yeah. Actually, Craig, you're the longest relationship I've ever had.
That's worrisome.
I know. Yeah. I think we're all going a little bit crazy, so we'll probably have to straighten up a bit now.
All right.
So even though the world's stopping a little bit, you haven't stopped at all, and you've been doing a hell of a lot of work in the future of workspace and gathering a lot of information and talking to a lot of people. Everybody is aware of the future of work. Very few people know how it's going to look. What sort of advice can you give us, Nicola? Yeah.
Oh, God. Well, me included. I don't know how it's going to look either. But it has been a really unusual time. And being, like, locked down again, I mean, the irony of even sitting here today talking to you about the future of work when we're all in lockdown again is, you know, not lost on me. Because I think from a confidence perspective, you know, having this lockdown has probably put us, you know, psychologically back 3 months.
Yeah.
You know, we'd started to gradually get used to being out more in the world, and hybrid working had started to evolve.
Yep.
In terms of, you know, some sort of rhythm, or at least most people had have some experience back in the office in some way, shape or form.
Mm.
And now we're back in a lockdown. And regardless of whether this lockdown ends on Thursday, as, you know, hypothetically,
yeah,
mythically it's meant to.
I'm going with it will. It will. I'm thinking positive.
It will, yeah.
It's going to be done and dusted. And
put it out there in the universe. Yeah, and
that's exactly right.
Yeah. I think, you know, let's hope that you are absolutely right.
As Craig will tell
because
you.
Because I have a winery tour to attend.
You don't want to cancel that.
No.
Yeah, well, I did this weekend.
Oh, so no.
If I can go next weekend, I'm totally there with bells on. But I think, you know, from a confidence perspective, that future of work, you know, we need to know that we feel safe and that there is a stability,
yeah,
that we can get a routine, that we can get a regularity, and that's been taken away.
Mm.
So I think to sort of come back to your question around what does it look like, I don't know. But what I have been doing, I don't know. If I knew, I would be selling those secrets for lots of money. not telling you. look, I think what I have been doing, though, is talking to a whole range of industries, different types of organizations, whether they're global, domestic, whether, you know, a huge, huge range of different types of industries and therefore workforces. You know, blue collar, customer facing, et cetera, to try and understand what the approach is from these organizations to carry on with business in a really completely shifted landscape. So there is nothing, and I think it's really quite a moment in time when you look at research and marketing research that was done, you know, where you've spent thousands and thousands of dollars getting people's sentiment, and in just 12 months' time, it's completely obsolete. It's like a line. If it's pre-pandemic, it's actually irrelevant, because that's just not the world we're in. It's so fundamental in terms of the shift.
Yeah. So with that, so most organisations now are considering normalising the hybrid working of and ongoing organisation-wide policies with this working from home and remote working, which does leave it a lot of flexibility, but there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all approach.
No.
So how does this impact companies' internal policies, as well as when you really want to get into it, it goes right down to industrial relations, it goes down to work from work safe, health and safety. There's so many facets to consider.
Yeah.
Absolutely right. And also, I think if you firstly ask the question around the maturity of the organisation, so for a lot of organisations that I've spoken to, before the pandemic, they didn't have a flexibility policy. So the pandemic has forced that policy change, which, you know, in itself is a really good outcome, probably. We would see that as a benefit, but it has, you know, meant a huge cultural change and forced. I think if we were to reflect on, you know, if we'd have been able to get this sort of whole spread movement of working from home organically, like how long would it have taken? It would have taken such a long time, but because there was no choice, you know, we got there really quickly. And I hear lots of concern that we might slip or be forced to try to go back to the way the world was before. And I don't think that that is where we will go.
I can't see that happening either, unless you work for Metricon Homes or whatever it was.
There's a lot of studies around the, you know, people, what their effectiveness or efficiency of working with from home is compared to working with the office. And they're coming, I'm seeing different results from some of these.
Well, PwC recently did a study on this, and they 51% of managers approached in this study were saying that productivity, there was an uplift, a significant uplift. So that's half.
But will that drop off, though? Will that drop off if it's permanent?
Well, I think... So I think the word productivity is not the right word these days. It's born of an industrial revolution when we worked on a conveyor belt and in how many nuts and bolts did we pack into that box, and that's a productivity measure, I think. But if we go with that for the right now, right, I think there's an underside to that, a dark belly, which is that people have never worked harder. And I think that one of the challenges for organizations is how do we make sure that we are balancing the volume of work when we are potentially always on. So I think there's a piece here around, and certainly there's been some union noise, and some organizations have started to respond with mandating that, you know, emails won't be sent after a certain time, et cetera, because of the... You know, if you have an EBA, you know, it might be that people working from home are working outside of the EBA hours and should be getting penalty rates, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, because all of this happened so quickly, our industrial landscape hasn't had the opportunity to catch up and have a model where people are working at times that may suit them. But also, you know, some people are finding it difficult to switch off, and the volume of work that's being produced is extraordinary. I know for my own team, it's been extraordinary that, you know, the volume of work we've been able to deliver remotely was unimaginable. But we have an obligation as organizations to think about people's health.
Yeah.
And that's, you know, physical health is you know, I don't know about you guys, but certainly I'm feeling a level of atrophy at the moment. I really need to get out and do a bit more exercise, but mental health as well and the ability to.
I think that's a huge priority for people, is their mental health and well-being, and that lack of switching off. I know I've caught myself working ridiculous hours over these lockdown periods. And what's one of the big things that you're hearing out there when you're approaching that particular issue with all the people you're speaking to?
So what I'm hearing is organisations for the first time, I think, and not to be unfair to organisations, mental health has always been a priority for organisations, but I don't think... I feel like what I'm hearing means there is actually a deeper level of understanding. It's a shared crisis.
Yeah.
It isn't something that's just impacted someone else that you... So even those people who potentially lack empathy or emotional intelligence and all of those sort of things, and we've heard about those leaders, and we probably all know one... they have a frame of reference because it's happening to them too.
Yeah.
And so for the first time, I truly, truly feel that mental health is understood as a priority, as opposed to just being espoused as a priority.
Yeah. Well, you talked before we came on air, you were saying that, you know, one of the things you said was we're all social beings, right? So sometimes if you're working from home and in a capacity when you're individual by yourself, that impacts people's mental health just as much as other things, right? Or it can. Do you think that there's, you know, with the future of work, do you think people will be hiring for those conditions? Do you think as part of the hiring process, they'll be looking at people who can cope better in a situation where they're put, their environment they have to work in?
That's a really great question. I don't know if that is high on the radar. I mean, what we have seen is certainly... 360, but certainly a review of the capabilities that we might look at.
Yeah.
You know, some organizations have gone along the lines of even reviewing their job architecture to determine where this role might be conducted.
Mm-hmm.
Like, but I think it's important to, I think, you know, we've all become really fixated on where we work as being the measure of flexibility, but it is only one. So if you think about true flexibility, where you work is a flexibility, when you work, but also how you work is a level of flexibility. And all of the conversations around hybrid work can just sit in that where you work from, but it's really, really important that when you're thinking about how you're constructing your workforce, that you think about those other elements, those two other buckets as well of, you know, when and how.
Yeah.
Because one size does not fit all. And I don't know that, you know, certainly from conversations, and there's been lots of surveys done, most people want to have some form of connection.
Yeah.
Mm. Yeah. You know, we are social. We want to have some form of connection. And when you think about the type of work that's best done face-to-face, you know, it is, you know, to a large part, collaboration, et cetera, but the office space or a space, and I think it's important to not just talk about office, because one of the trends is the, you know, shared working space. And hearing about that a lot in the US, where they're using retail space in suburbs to, you know, be co-working spaces for people located in that area rather than all traveling into a center. So there's lots of different approaches to that, but the ability to come together and have relationships and socialize and ideate usually is better face to face. There's lots of technology that we're claiming to be able to do that just as well.
Yeah, but it's technology. It's not the same as when you run into someone making that cup of tea in the kitchen and you have a bit of a chat, something gets mentioned. Oh, so-and-so used to do that. They're over in my area. Come and chat to them. They might have some ideas. It's those little bits of banter that lead to something great
and to solve
problems, and that interaction. And I think we've really, it's on a mental health level, we're missing that. On a managerial level, we're missing that. And some little things are getting blown out of proportion, and it's yeah, I think it's going to definitely be a hybrid mix going forward, but it is, as you said, everyone's different. What's it going to look like?
Different organisations have taken different approaches, right? So this is what I'm finding really fascinating. And some organisations, and we all know who they are, you know, they've come out and gone, everyone, work wherever you like. Everybody, yep, love everybody. Go and work wherever you like. We don't mind, right? And they're sort of being lauded as perhaps the, and perhaps they are, the futurists. But actually, I think if you just took a little step back and reviewed the why is it attractive for them to do that, usually it's because they're tech.
Yes.
We have a significant skill shortage. It makes sense to move the work to where the skill is, where the people are, right? And trying to force people into a specific geography is not going to enable them to fill those roles. No. So there's a very practical reason why they're doing that, not just that they're benevolent.
And also, then, you know, not that... The tech space, and I don't want to be too stereotypical, but a lot of these people live online, and that enclosed space, staring at a screen and interacting via that, is something that appeals long term to a lot of people within that space. It's easier, you know, whereas other areas. So let me throw this at you. You work, RMIT is a huge eclectic organisation.
Oh, that's a good word. Yes, we are eclectic. Yeah.
Oh, God, yes.
So what, and you would have completely different needs for different parts of your business.
Yeah.
How are you guys going with that hybrid model? Or what have you got some processes in place or policies that sit across the whole university or across different aspects? You know, I know, and I'll just add a layer on that. I visited you guys a couple of months ago in your new digs, and it's this amazing interactive, collaborative, almost like a shared workspace. Mm-hmm. That's built really, I want to say purpose built, but encourages, you know, a collegiate environment. So where what are you guys doing? What's the... Whew.
Yeah, so it's a great question. And the reason that this research sort of came about and why I've been talking to so many people is to try and inform our thinking.
Yep.
So, you know, we are a academic institute, and therefore, you know, it's in our nature to be curious about what everyone else is doing and to try and, you know, come up with the best and avoid the worst. But I liken RMIT to a mini city.
Yeah.
Right? If you think about our footprint, we own something like, I don't know, 5 to 7% of the CBD. Those stats vary depending on who I talk to, but a lot of it. And we have a gigantic population. Not as gigantic at the moment without, you know, our normal cohort of international students, but it's still significant in terms of the footfall. And that brings with it a whole sort of gamut around, you know, wellness, safety, property services, all of those sort of things that you would expect.
Yeah.
But then, you know, we have our disciplines. So we're huge in research and innovation, and that requires lab time, but it also requires time to write and publish.
Yep.
Mm.
You know, we have a lot of customer-facing time, learning and teaching. Face-to-face student interaction requires, you know, a certain presence. But then, you know, the evolution or the blending of digital learning, and some things are better learned digitally, some things are not.
Yep.
And how do we make sure that our students get the best of both of those elements? And then, of course, we have very practical skills. We've got a huge VE, vocational education college, where you learn to be a sparky or a nurse, and you can't do that.
Oh, gosh, no.
Digitally, you need practical support. So I think...
There's only so many times you can jab a needle into an orange.
That's totally right.
I remember when I was at university, a girlfriend of mine was studying nursing, and that's what they used to do, was stick the needles into oranges.
You wouldn't have any problems these days finding a real person to stick a needle into, I wouldn't have thought.
Oh, I think there's a lot of people who'd be happy to have a needle.
Yeah, exactly.
There's no needles, right? That's the problem. Sorry, you get a bit controversial. No, anyway. So I think the short answer to that is one size does not fit all.
Yep.
You have to approach the needs of the work that's being delivered, and then how do we best support people to deliver that work in a meaningful way that also gives them what they're hoping for in terms of flexibility. I mean, we were and are an employer of choice, and so we have a very mature policy around flexibility. So that hasn't really needed to be looked at. Mm. But, you know, I would not be sitting here, you know, declaring that RMIT has got it solved, because nobody has.
Mm.
And in fact, you know, I was just reflecting on that question that you asked earlier around productivity. And, you know, it was really sad to learn that the fastest growing tech was surveillance tech. To understand what people were doing and how many hours they were online, et cetera, et cetera. And I think, you know, the where you work is one question, like, can we make it work? But the bigger question is, how do we get organizational trust?
Yeah.
And how do we get leaders to a place where we're looking at the output and we're looking at the output in a really balanced way? You know, should the output of work be the same when you're in lockdown and you're homeschooling? Well, no.
Mm.
You know, logic tells you that it couldn't be, but some organizations will be very kind in their approach and others not. And I think that is actually the silver bullet around how we go forward. And that is not a new issue, that's always been the issue.
Hey, can we narrow the focus a little bit, maybe to your team or the people that either directly or indirectly report to you, and also forget what's happened over the last couple of weeks? So where were you headed prior to this last outbreak, if you like, or cluster?
Yeah.
Where was your team headed in terms of their you know, work?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, good question. So the team were given a large amount of choice around the work, sort of the work they're doing being, you know, if they've got like a heap of ad response to go through, that's probably better at home.
Yep.
If we're running second round interviews, that's probably better on campus,
mm-hmm.
as long as everyone feels comfortable with it. I mean, the challenge is, I mean, you could do all, and we have, and we've all done it, you could do all of talent acquisition digitally, but I don't want to join a new company and then the first time I see the environment that I'm going to be working in, even if I'm only working there 1 or 2 days a week, be on my first day. So I think there's a thing here around candidates and what do candidates need to make great decisions in this market,
mm.
where there's so many counter offers and there's so many vacancies, et cetera, et cetera. So how do you really show your value proposition?
Well, that brings me to my next point. You actually won an ITA last year for candidate experience, didn't you?
The segue queen over here.
That's smooth. It's like we rehearsed.
See, if you guys keep telling me how smooth I am, it's not smooth. So your candidate experience is just a beacon and clearly an example to all. So let's get into that a bit.
Has it changed much too?
Well, undoubtedly it's changed. I mean, you certainly would never have moved everything digitally, right?
Yeah.
You just wouldn't.
Mm.
Because, you know, for the reason I just sort of articulated, the face-to-face, the connection, the relationship with who you're going to be working with is a fundamental part of your decision-making. Mm-hmm. You know, if you meet someone and you think, oh, God, I don't think much of that person, like, it's unlikely that you're going to want to commit your life to that job. But it has changed. And whilst I would like to think that you know, it's not been a terrible experience for candidates, there hasn't been a lot of choice in the design of how we have supported candidates. I mean, certainly there's been some enhancements. We've certainly tried to make the digital process as easy as possible. But I don't think, I mean, people like, depending on the role, but usually you want some sort of human connection. I mean, that said, I mean, we recruited a lot of people last year. We onboarded a lot of people. Onboarding still remains a challenge. You know, there is lots of tech to support it out in the marketplace, but it doesn't feel the same to new starters and to hiring managers and the teams welcoming those new starters, because you don't get to connect in the same way. And so when, you know, one of the things to think about with the future of work is all of the unintended consequences that we're going to need to be aware of. And, you know, you've already spoken about that, Lauren, when you mentioned, you know, the chat in the kitchen. But if you have new people coming into the organization, how are you very deliberate about making sure that that chat in the kitchen is orchestrated, that they get the opportunity to be able to develop relationships and network and get up to speed in the same way that, you know, it's not the same, but in a way that they would do if they had that opportunity by osmosis to learn and connect and to speak and to, you know, get introduced to people. So you've got to be very, very deliberate.
It's a very big cultural piece, isn't it?
And it
is hard because, you know, no matter what career you choose or job you head down, quite often we spend more time in that workplace with those people than we do with our family or the people that we've chosen as friends. And
what are you saying about your family?
But what I'm saying is to make that decision primarily digitally across, you know, the recruiting aspect makes it really difficult. There's probably, and it's probably way too early for any data to come out, but that first embedded period just after the onboarding, the first 3 to 6 months, I'd love to see any data that's come out on what, you know, success or lack of success for bringing people into your business when it's been a digital process.
I think that will be really interesting, but I don't think that we're going to see anything meaningful yet.
Yeah, not even a year away,
because
at least.
Everyone's very forgiving because there's been no choice.
Yep.
So there's I think there's great goodwill and sentiment that everyone's trying their best, you know. Let's use the word because we haven't used it yet, unprecedented events. You know, everyone's trying their best. This is a new way of working. I think actually when we get to a more normalized state, that's when candidates' expectations will shift and be less generous, potentially. And I think that's when we'll start to see the impacts of a crappy onboarding experience.
And candidates are becoming more demanding right now with the, you know, with the competition for talent.
Gosh, yes.
And, you know, there's all sorts of things that are being brought to the table earlier in a recruitment process than they were in the past. You know, more money, you know, the flexibility, what else have you got? You know, all those sorts of things. And it's a different trail we're on with candidate experience to what it was a year ago and even, you know, probably 18 months ago, where candidates have the power in a lot of industries right now. You know, we're all facing it.
Yeah, that's true. A lot of tech so in demand.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I think it's a great thing. You know, and long may it live. I mean, I have walked that sort of path where you have kids at school, but you want to be taken seriously in the marketplace. And, you know, there's always been that challenge around balancing the ask around flexibility and the potential impact that it has on the way you're viewed or your career, et cetera, et cetera. And I think that whilst asking for flexibility and all of those sort of things at the moment is amazing, what I'm fearful of is that we'll start to see division, you know, gender-led division, where it is more socially acceptable for women to ask for flexibility. It always has been, and that's been one of the biggest barriers to getting gender equity, because when men are not taking up those flexible offerings, you know, it means that someone else is carrying the load. Yeah. So even in the return to offices, we're seeing that men are more willing to come back into the office, and that we need to be very, very careful that we're putting in checkpoints and observation points to make sure that we don't one day wake up and the office has become the new golf course.
Yeah.
Or the new boys club.
Welcome to 1955.
It's a really good point, though, because there is a danger of that, isn't there? Because of the and circumstances that are out of the control of normal, whatever normal is these days, it could lead to a secondary state or set back gender equality in the workplace a period of time. It could.
Yeah. Well, it absolutely has.
Yeah.
You know, I don't think the stats are starting to come out around the number of women who have left the workplace. And whilst the government, you know, with the latest budget is trying hard to encourage women to come back into the workplace with, you know, childcare support, etc., etc., I am genuinely fearful that it is too little too late, and our social norms and the role modelling of our government around the treatment of women means that, you know, I'm really, really lucky. My husband is a researcher. Mm. We met at university, and I remind him on a daily basis that I'm just as smart as he is, and I have a piece of paper to prove it, right? And that relationship, because we both work full-time, I feel that I shouldn't feel lucky about this, but I do, that he is the one taking the lead on homeschooling this week. But that's not the case in most households.
No.
Most women are picking up the burden. And then, you know, we're all, you know, talent acquisition will be battered in the next year to tell us why we can't get more women in. We need to run more female-only campaigns, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And the truth of the matter is that we actually need to take a good, long, hard look internally at our talent management practices. And what are we doing for the women in our workplace to make sure they can stay, that they are getting supported, and that there's career pathways?
That's a brilliant point.
It's a good topic, though, because it's very, very true. We're seeing so many women having to step back and also step up with homeschooling and work. There's a colleague of ours who is in the C-suite in a very large corporation here in Melbourne, and I was talking to her privately. She's had to pick up her running what she does with work, homeschooling, because her husband's of the opinion that his job's a bit better than hers, even though it's not. She earns the money. But homeschooling's not his responsibility.
Wow.
Yeah, I mean, I do hear stories like this, and, you know, one of the unintended consequences of hybrid working could well be that we perpetuate this social norm.
Yep.
Women continue to work from home, men come back. Thank God that's over. I don't have to deal with that shit anymore and come back to the office. Mm. And then all of the very human things that happen after that, when you look around the office and, you know, you build those relationships, you think about who you should get to work on this project. You know, I think you've heard it, you know, mentioned many times that women start to become the invisible workforce.
Mm.
And what does that do? And we've barely made any progress. You know, everyone's sort of talking about how we might undo all of that great work. Well, I'm of the opinion that very little great work has actually come to fruition.
Mm.
So the amount of noise and effort and money spent, right? And actually, this is a really good moment to think about, if hybrid work is the future, what does that mean to the way that homes are and the work of the home? Regardless of whether you have kids or you don't have kids, you know, there's always that domestic duty, and where does it fall?
In your research and your discussions over the last few months around the future of work, has this been a recurring topic, or has this been something people are dancing around? What is it, front of mind?
Yeah. It is front of mind for lots of organisations that are mature enough to actually see the writing on the wall. So those organisations who are already quite evolved in their inclusion strategies, absolutely this is something that is of concern. And from a practical perspective, we have a talent shortage.
Yeah, yeah.
So I mean,
how do we solve it? How do we solve this, though? How do we make sure that this
1955
doesn't come back and women's places in the kitchen? Because it's
I don't think it's as overt as but I do think that role modelling has a really strong place, and role modelling at a senior leadership level sets the tone of your organisation.
Yeah.
So if you know, all of your senior leaders decide that being present physically is the way that they are choosing to operate in this world where a hybrid is about choice and around, you know, how and where you work. If they're all back, it sends a very strong signal.
It does, doesn't it?
That being back in the office is the way to go. And yes, you could work hybridly because we have policies to support it. You could work remotely, but good luck asking for it, you know. And this is not a new thing. I'm really sad to share this example, but a very close friend of mine was looking to return from maternity leave, and her partner, her husband, wanted to take carer's leave. There was a policy to support it, some guidelines to support it. Sorry, guidelines, not policy. And the guidelines said that, you know, you go and talk to your manager. And he did, and his manager was a man, and he was declined. And so that sort of behaviour is the stuff that needs to be highlighted, called out, and beaten out of our organisations if, you know, we're to not fall into this problem. Now, lots of organisations are quite mature and would not be scared to name and shame and call that behaviour out, but others not so much, and that's the problem.
Yeah. It opens so many cans of worms. You know, looking at future of work and even where we've been over the last sort of, you know, year to 18 months, it offers up more questions than answers in all of this. You know, one of the other things, see, you also, as a university, won the ITA last year for corporate social responsibility. Has what's gone on in the world over the last 12 to 18 months impacted organisations' ability to be, you know, socially responsible? Has, you know, is there the investment, is there the resource to be able to be at a level? Like, you guys work a lot within the Indigenous space.
Yeah.
Has anything been impacted over the last year that has forced you to pull back in any way?
Yeah, it's a great question, and absolutely it has. So, you know, in the higher education space, you know, it's no secret that higher education is really hurting because our borders are closed, so we don't have the student numbers that we would normally have. The commitment to Indigenous recruitment at RMIT is unshakable. So, but like all really large, complex organisations, there are often unintended consequences. And so last year we held a really tight handle on being able to go externally to bring in new roles, and that had an impact on the number of Indigenous people who joined our organisation. So our commitment to bringing in Indigenous talent and making sure that our Indigenous talent within RMIT is well supported, and that didn't falter. You know, last year we were still really committed to career pathways. We were still really committed to learning and development of our Indigenous talent, but certainly had an impact. And I think it would have had an impact across all of Australia, not just with Indigenous recruitment, but all types of recruitment that requires more focus and effort. We saw organisations dismantling their talent teams.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, my goodness, yes.
I mean, it was heartbreaking to see that that was the response from some organisations, and it's very telling of the maturity, I think, of those organisations. It was so short-sighted in terms of disbanding that particular function, because it is just seen as a cost centre. And I was, you know, really grateful to RMIT for the support of my team in that time, where my team pivoted to support other things. So my team, whilst we weren't recruiting externally, they were supporting students, making sure that, you know, when we turned off, when we all locked down and we turned off all of the ways that student could earn money, some money, that, you know, the university sprang into action with hardship funds to try and support international students. Got no family here, got no earnings, no income, and we just abandoned them for a period of time. And that's exactly what's happening at the minute. It's a very shameful and sort of heartbreaking approach to people who are not Australian.
Yep.
And they don't have a network around them, and how are they going to pay their rent? So there's all, I sort of digressed a little bit, but I think if you look at that question around the impact in community, those businesses are closed. No one's recruiting hospitality staff. No one's recruiting retail staff. Mm-hmm. You know, we would normally be, you know, pounding through the volume of work, and there's no opportunities, and that has a devastating impact into the community.
Yeah. Even something else that you said just a little bit earlier there about all different kinds of diversity recruitment, which a lot of organisations, mature organisations, had had and continue to have a great handle on, and set themselves either official or unofficial targets. But in a candidate short market where positions or requisitions are so important to get someone in, and if the level of candidate or the numbers of candidates from diverse backgrounds aren't coming in, that must impact in this market where, you know, in the candidate short, it must indirectly or directly impact people's ability to hit whatever targets they've set themselves.
Of course it would.
Yeah, it would. Mm. But, you know, targets should... So you can hit a target, talent... This is a thing to think about. Like, talent acquisition is often asked to hit the target, and then very little focus is genuinely given to the longer term retention. So, you know, we all know this. It's, you know, it's the irony of the external commitment that organizations say they have, and then the actual reality once you get into the organization. In an externally scarce pool, you need to elevate your talent management practices and look internally.
Yep.
The sad truth is we all know that getting promoted is easier externally than internally, that should not be the case. We need, and this is a great, I feel like the beginning, a silver lining, I'm very optimistic about the pandemic, is that I think managers and leaders have become more human in terms of the way that they present themselves. You know, it's a great equalizer that, you know, you have the dog jumping on the keyboard.
Exactly.
And, you know, the doorbell's ringing in the middle of a presentation.
Kids come flying in, Mom, this happened in homeschooling.
And
it's made us all very human on those Zoom calls where the cat's called across the keyboard.
It's given us permission, hasn't it, to be a bit more.
And I do hope that that evolves into actually understanding our people more and their aspirations more and their skills more, and actually investing internally in, I touched on it earlier, the capabilities that people are thinking about now are different to the capabilities pre-pandemic, and you can't just go out and buy that.
Yeah.
So you need to grow it. So you need to build it, grow it. And that's very sticky. You know, as employees, if you feel your organization truly hears you, cares about you, knows what you want, that's a very sticky approach to retention. No one's leaving, because we all know that that's really rare.
Yeah.
So if organizations put that focus internally, yeah. What an amazing world it would
be. A whole new topic of internal mobility and how to manage those conversations and get the best out of your people.
And all this ties back into the future of work, which is where we started today, isn't it? So,
totally.
I mean, we could go on for a lot longer, but time won't let us.
Oh, please don't, because I'm sure I've made people totally nod off.
No, I can't believe that we're really just scratching the surface here. And
oh God, yes.
And I've been writing down a whole lot of notes, and I think, oh my God, there's another episode in this. There's another whole discussion around this. There's another.
Done the same thing.
So thank you so much for sharing that with us. It's been great
to see you, Nicola. Oh, as always, a pleasure. And I can't wait to see the submissions that you guys are going to put in for the ITAS this year. And I cannot wait to see you at the event in your fabulous frock.
I'll totally be frocking up. I love that.
I'm going to have to rent and just wait, because my girth is changing on a daily basis.
Yeah, he's got COVID belly.
I'm not locking into anything right now.
We all have the COVID kilos.
Yeah, well, I've minimised mine. I've been reasonably good, but...
She cut her arm off.
Yeah. I lost a limb.
On that note, we'll leave it here, I think. But thanks Absolutely. So much, Nicola, and that's a goodbye from me.
And a goodbye from me.
Bye.
Thanks for having me.
Today's episode of TARPOD was sponsored by CV Check, the leader in background screening across Australia and New Zealand.
Verifying candidate credentials shows your commitment to bringing the best people into your business and delivering on high standards in service, products and culture.
Yes, Craig, CV Check helped over 26,000 other businesses.
Big number.
Huge, including Optus, Canva and PwC New Zealand.
So get a demo today by reaching out to cvcheck.com, and don't forget to tell them
TARPOD sent you.
Thanks for listening to TARPOD. Please don't forget to subscribe and look out for upcoming podcasts.
If only we had a HR department, I'd be marching in there every day about you.
Oh, shit. Yeah. Why don't you write me an email?
I've heard about her friendly hands.
Yeah. They're jazz hands.